Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. If you were around in 1983 and listening much to Top 40 radio, you undoubtedly remember this song, Thomas Dolby's synth-pop hit, She Blinded Me with Science, complete with an iconic music video that featured its creator as a wild-haired mad scientist. But these days, Thomas Dolby is a tech geek of a different sort. He continues to make his own music, but his career has branched out considerably into film music, video game soundtracks, and perhaps most surprisingly, he is the founder of Beatnik, the world's largest provider of cell phone ringtone software. Thomas, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Your debut album was called The Golden Age of Wireless, and now, a quarter century later, we really are living through a golden age of wireless.
Well, it took the industry a couple of decades to catch up. I mean, actually, you know, truthfully, I was talking about the, you know...
You were talking old wireless.
Old wireless, you know. So my parents' generation would crowd around the wireless, you know, to listen to the news from the war, you know, those kinds of things.
So the idea that that radio was kind of, you know, it was this family medium and there was a whole sort of... set of images, a kind of Norman Rockwell America, except I guess in your case it was UK, of this imagery surrounding the radio.
Absolutely, and you know, I've always been fascinated by things that used to be very modern, you know, used to be very futuristic, and radio to me had that sort of uniting sense in a lot of ways. But I was very interested in the ham radio operator, you know, the sort of the rebel out on his own in his garden shed, you know. Sort of the pirating the airwaves.
Yeah. Well, now, you actually have moved to sort of the forefront of the current wireless technology, founding Beatnik, I guess, in the 90s.
Well, it was a roundabout route, really. At the beginning of the 90s, I quit the business, actually. I didn't really announce it as such, but I was totally disillusioned with the music industry. You know, after having a couple of commercial hits in the mainstream, the assumption on the part of the labels and all the people around me was, well, presumably you're going to just refine that formula and milk it for us a couple dozen more times. But the other side to my music was this more introspective, atmospheric side. And they weren't remotely interested in 1991 in developing that. But conversely, I saw the internet coming and I saw, you know, what would happen when one day musicians could record in their back room and hit a button and instantly get out to millions of fans. And that seemed to me a big step forward in the lifestyle for a musician. But it was still too far off. So I moved to Silicon Valley really to try and influence those tech companies to accelerate that process. And it was never meant to be, you know, 15 years, but one thing led to another and my company, Beatnik, ended up becoming very successful. After riding out the whole web boom and bust,
right,
we really found success in the cell phone industry when Nokia came to us interested in you know, improving their ringtones, and they licensed our technology and put it in hundreds of millions of phones.
So now, in addition to Nokia, Motorola and Samsung?
Panasonic, Sony Ericsson, all of the world's top manufacturers use Beatnik.
Now, what about this other company you founded called Retrotones?
Well, you know, I had this sort of pang of guilt after Beatnik started showing up in hundreds of millions of cell phones because I heard a lot of people, especially people of my age, you know, complaining about ringtones.
Uh-huh.
And it is mainly an age thing, you know, because if you ask a 15-year-old, you know, it's just part of the landscape. But on the side, I had a little content company, which was, you know, our raison d'etre was to create more interesting sounding ringtones. So we had everything from 50s B-movie sci-fi sound effects to Great Lies of History, which is mostly clips from American presidents' speeches, through to...
So you mean you call somebody up and their phone will say, "I am not a crook"?
Absolutely, yeah, that's one of them. Or, you know, I'll say it again, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. These are the great lies of history. And then we have endangered species mating calls. So, you know, you can have on your phone as a ringtone the kawaii uh-oh, which is, you know, virtually extinct. But hopefully if, you know, you're outdoors and your phone goes off with the mating call, if there's any uh-ohs left around, they'll be attracted. And who knows, you might find them humping your phone.
Well, you'd prefer them to get all hot and bothered with each other if they're endangered. But I guess the big question is, are there any Thomas Dolby ringtones?
Oh, nobody would be interested in them. Come.
Do you think, I mean, what's your feeling about ringtones? If someone said, yeah, I really want to have hyperactive on my phone, would you just be completely offended by the idea? Or?
No, personally, I'm not offended by it. You know, to me, it's like somebody whistling the tune to Hyperactive, which is certainly when I walk down the street happens. Somebody walking behind me will just start whistling Hyperactive, which I suppose is not too bad. When Dr. Magnus Pike would come to America, people would run up behind him and go, "Science!" And it just scare him out of his shoes.
Now, you have to explain who Dr. Pike is.
So he was a sort of TV celebrity scientist on the BBC all the time I was growing up.
He was Mr. Wizard,
yeah, exactly,
for the UK.
Exactly. And so I hired him, you know, to come in and do the recording and then to be in the video. But he took himself very seriously. He's no longer with us, but he took himself very seriously. And in the States, of course, he wasn't known until my video came out. So he was rather offended that he would come here and people thought he was just some bit part actor that I'd hired for the video.
We're speaking with Thomas Dolby, who's performing tonight and tomorrow night at Joe's Pub. Tonight is sold out, but the late show tomorrow night, there are still tickets available. And this is, Thomas, it's been 15 years. As you say, it wasn't intentional, but one thing didn't lead to another, and so it's been 15 years since you've been back out.
Yeah.
And how are you finding it now?
Well, I'm loving it. You know, it's obviously very different from playing with a full band at Radio City Music Hall, but what I like about it is that I've picked the songs that I'm playing. I've picked the audience that I'm playing them to. And the cool thing is that during the 15 years I was away, there have been websites and forums where people are discussing my music every day. And in a way, it's sort of gathered momentum on the internet. But interestingly, it's not She Blinded Me With Science or Hyperactive or Europa they're talking about. They're arguing about the chord sequence in the intro to Budapest by Blimp or an obscure lyric in verse 3 of Airwaves. And when I wrote those, I had no idea whether I was connecting with anybody out there. You know, with the hits, it was easier to read the royalty statements, read the radio playlist. But why were people buying the albums? Was it because of the hits, or was it because they discovered this quieter side to my music? You didn't know, and the record industry was they didn't really care. You know, it's just units sold. But nowadays, you know, because of the internet, you know exactly who is buying your stuff. Everybody that, you know, comes to my website, I know who they are, how they got there, what they like about me. I'm having this sort of ongoing discussion with them. And I see the same faces, you know, that I've seen in the forums show up at my gigs. And it's very gratifying.
Well, now, when we talk about technology, it's funny that usually the implication is we're talking about new technology. You've already mentioned, you know, with wireless, the way you took the word 25 years ago, that you like to look at older, obsolete forms of technology. My understanding is that this current tour, you are traveling around with some 1940s vintage oscilloscopes.
Oscilloscopes are field measurement equipment from the Royal Navy or the US Air Force. And I've just always had a fetish for big dials and knobs, you know. And these days, because of eBay, you can pick up these fabulous devices for, you know, sometimes 10 or 15 bucks. It costs, you know, 40 bucks to ship them to my PO box. But what I do is I gut them and I retrofit them for MIDI. And once they're outputting MIDI, I can use them to control anything I like. So, you know, the sound source, the original sound source is basically a computer. But it wouldn't be very exciting to see a guy with his head buried in a laptop. So what you see is me, you know, tinkering with these big knobs and dials. And then on my head, I have a helmet cam that was designed for the US military to do synchronized building entries. And my point of view is projected behind me on a big screen. So I build the tracks up block by block, if you like, starting with, you know, just a drum pattern, a bass part, a couple of keyboard parts. And once the groove is going, I sing the song over the top. And you can see what I'm doing projected behind me on a big screen.
Hmm.
And when I first did it, I thought it would only be the geeks that were interested. But it turns out that people have never been anywhere near this kind of music software. They're just totally enthralled.
You have National Security Administration people lurking in the back of your sets, too. All this military technology out there on stage.
Well, you'd think so, yeah. You know, a lot of these boxes, the way they were built, you'd think that if they ran out of bombs to drop on the Germans, they just... you know, heave the equipment out of the window and wipe out entire cities. They're massive and very well built.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Thomas Dolby, and we've mentioned the golden age of wireless, and it's a terrific record. It's one that I wore out at least one copy of in the 80s, and it wasn't because of Blinded Me with Science, because the original version of Golden Age of Wireless didn't have that song on it. Mm-hmm. But Hyperactive, certainly another of your hits. So, I mean, you've alluded to this before. You become, if not a one-hit wonder, you know, the industry wants you to be a two-hit wonder and then a three-hit wonder. Mm-hmm. Do you look back at Hyperactive and She Blinded Me with Science and think, you know, that was a moment and that moment's over, or do you still find yourself being drawn back to those two?
You know, I mean, I look at some artists' careers and I see that quite skillfully they've managed the transition from, you know, the sort of very energized, you know, somewhat adolescent stuff that they started off with into a more mature career, like, a Sting or whatever. And sometimes I'm envious of that because I sort of think it'd be nice if I could just be doing my ballads and things today. But not really. I wouldn't trade places with anybody. Enough people have discovered the real substance of my music that I feel pretty good about it.
Hyperactive is the name of that song from Thomas Dolby. It's one of his hits from the 80s, along with, of course, She Blinded Me with Science, Europa, and the Pirate Twins. But there always was, Thomas, this other side to your music, and, you know, people who got the albums would be drawn to songs like Leipzig mm-hmm. and Cloudburst on Shingle Street, and my particular favorite, One of Our Submarines, which to me always had the feeling of, in Old English, those ballads that tell a story. It was kind of like a 20th century version of extension of that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of music did you grow up listening to, and how did you come to this sort of dual kind, you know, the hyperactive pop music and the more introspective stuff?
I listened to a wide range of music. I was never a huge across-the-board music fan, the kind of person that just buys every album and pores over the back cover and the credits and lyrics and stuff. I saw the Beatles in 1963 when I was 5 years old at Hammersmith Odeon, and got to meet Paul McCartney the other night and told him about that, and he'd forgotten that gig even existed, which I thought was kind of funny because every Beatles fan is familiar with that poster with Jerry and the Pacemakers and Freddie and the Dreamers and stuff, and to him it was like, I may have played there, you know, I don't remember. Through to I think the first album I bought with my own pocket money was Elton John, Honky Chateau, and at the same time I was very into Joni Mitchell. And then from there I discovered, you know, Van Morrison, Frank Zappa, Captain Beefheart. And mostly they were eccentric individuals that are very hard to pigeonhole, that wrote great lyrics and didn't really conform to any single style. They just sort of did their thing. Every A&R executive's nightmare, in other words.
Right.
And these were the people that I really wanted to emulate. And it was somewhat surprising to me, actually, when I got a big record deal and they put me in the studio and then managed to get in the charts. And I never really expected to be a mainstream artist like that.
So She Blinded Me with Science is clearly a very eccentric song.
Yeah.
But certainly the video that went with it was a big part of its initial push. I mean, did you see that particular line of writing on the wall?
Well, I mean, in that case, the video almost came before the song itself. You know, I think I had a title, and then I saw the pictures in my head for the video and the whole scenario with the professor and the sexy lab assistant and all the rest of it. And you know, at the time, nobody really knew what a music video was supposed to be, and yet MTV was starting to become very influential. And in fact, in the States, I was not getting radio play, or in England for that matter, I was not really getting radio play with this stuff. I was getting some club play, you know, in dance clubs with Science, but not radio play. But MTV was starting to get in the major cities, and hip people were staying home on a Saturday night to watch MTV, because that was where they were getting their information from about what was hot and what was out there.
Right.
And so radio was influenced, you know, by what MTV was playing. So once that slotted into place, you know, I had a catchy song and a look and a name and so on. And a lot of my contemporaries, don't forget, were sort of, you know, pin-up, like panty melters, like your Simon Le Bons and Adam Ants and Stings and so on. And so I went the other way, you know, and all of my family are academics, you know. Generations of us have been Trinity Dons and at Cambridge and things like this. And my father was a professor of classical archaeology, and my mother was a math teacher. And all my brothers and sisters, you know, academic of one sort or another. So I went back to that, you know. That was the obvious way for me to go back and sort of plug into that and into the humorous side of it.
Mm-hmm. A month ago, on your blog, first of all, you've been blogging sort of relentlessly recently, I guess, with this tour, telling people the stories of the songs and the touring.
I take a camera with me, you know, and in fact, I was kicking myself 10 minutes ago because I bumped into Phil Collins in your corridor, and I'm thinking, damn, where was my camera? That was a perfect blog entry. But yeah, I mean, I've really enjoyed doing that, and people comment back about the blog, and people are really interested, you know, to see me sort of take the lid off my life and how I'm going about this.
Now, that's online at blog.thomasdolby.com, and about a month ago on your blog, you went after Kevin Federline, Mr. Britney Spears, for somewhat flagrantly sampling one of your songs.
Well, a fan brought it to my attention, and my web mistress, you know, had pointed it out to me. I went and looked at it, and frankly, I'd never heard of him up to that point. You know, I don't really watch TV or sort of read People magazine, and I'm not really into the, you know, celebrity watch thing. So, of course, I know who Britney is. But I found myself going to MySpace, you know, to Kevin's page. And sure enough, there was this song that was actually sampled from a record made by Mobb Deep, the rap group, which they had legally licensed from me. They took the string hook from Science and made a loop of it and rapped over the top of it. And there, you know, they paid a fee and I got a credit, and that was all cool. But Kevin had looped their song, a sample from their song, and done this sort of vitriolic rap over the top of it, which had he come and asked me, I don't think I would have approved it. He's making an album. I think I would have said, no, you can't just vandalize my song like that. If anybody's going to sing, you know, sassy lyrics over my groove, it's going to be me. So we sent him a cease and desist letter, and they promptly took the song down, sort of claiming ignorance, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, my lawyers are sort of figuring out what to do next. But it's gone, which is the main thing.
Well, you know, this comes back to something you said very early on in our conversation, which is that you saw the internet coming and that it might be a great thing for a musician to be able to press a button and reach millions of people. You can press a button and reach millions of people, but you can also be sharing an artist's, you know, work with hundreds, potentially thousands of your friends. And so it is kind of a double-edged sword. Where are you on that whole file sharing situation?
Well, you know, I mean, a part of music has always been free. You know, when we gave songs to radio or gave songs to MTV, they would go sell advertising around our content and we were paying for it. But you do that because, you know, as musicians, the first thing you do is you want people to love you. You know, and most musicians, given a choice of fame or fortune, they'd actually take the fame. I mean, we're basically exhibitionists that want to be plastered over, you know, the window of every Tower Records store. If we also make a living or even get rich doing it, sort of icing on the cake. So the first thing you do is you need people to get hooked on your music. We're basically drug dealers, you know. You give away free
first
samples.
First one's free.
And the first one's free, and then they come back. So the internet is the ultimate expression of that, you know, to date. I mean, it's just amazing, the reach of the internet. However, that said, it should be the artist or his or her representatives that make the choice of where you draw the line, what you give away for free. Now, if you go to Grokster or whatever the current flavor is and you download one of my songs from there, that came off a disc which had a copyright notice on it. And at the time when I recorded that disc, that was the only way to go, you know. And so somebody ripped that disc and flagrantly, you know, broke the copyright laws and ripped it and put it online. And I don't feel good about that. It's like somebody looted my house.
Hmm.
So I'm not against it per se, but I don't feel good about the back catalogue stuff getting out there, especially when it's hard for me to persuade my record company to repress and reprint my old CDs. So now I have no argument at all. I can't say to a fan, you know, write to EMI and tell them to re-release the Flat Earth, because they can just go download it off, you know, whatever the peer-to-peer network is.
Right. Well, now, I mean, you're no stranger to legal proceedings and stuff. I mean, your use of the name Dolby. I know it was like a childhood nickname or something, but there is a Dolby Labs. They work in the field of sound, and they at some point must have had something to say to you about, you know, the name.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't like that I used the name very much. Their lawsuit actually didn't get very far, because there are many precedents of, you know, your Bowies and Glitters and Stars and Monroes, and, you know, Monroe Shock Absorbers never went after Marilyn Monroe, you know, over assuming that name. And so there's a lot of cases in history where people have done that. And so there was nothing that they could do about it, really.
So the upshot being that you're allowed to continue to use the name, and
yeah, I mean, you know, we settled it, and I said, well, I promised not to manufacture noise reduction equipment anytime soon.
We're speaking with Thomas Dolby. So is there, I mean, now that you're back out, back in the game, is there a new album in the future?
Album, what a quaint concept.
Is there a series of ringtones that you're composing?
I'm done with ringtones for now, actually. I'm getting back into you know, serious music. But, you know, the nice thing now is there's no single unit of currency. I mean, I could record a song in my hotel room and hit a button and it would be live on my site and hundreds or thousands of people would have it by morning. Then in 2 weeks' time, if I decide I don't like the second verse, I could take it off and put up another one and put them both up. You know, I can have it remixed a year from now by a DJ in Europe. I mean, in the old days, there was this limited shelf life. You know, there's a sell-by date. You had your record company would slot you in to this narrow window between their other promotions. And if it didn't catch fire within a certain number of weeks, then it's back to the drawing board, you know.
Right.
And now I can put this stuff online and it might have a spike this month and then nothing for 6 months. And then a movie comes out and it's featured in it and you see another spike. And so I'm building a portfolio of digital assets that will go on accruing value over time. And I love that about it.
Well, when you mention movies, Mission Impossible 3 has your music. You also mentioned remixes. We're actually going to conclude with a remix from the import album called One of Our Submarines. This is the Thomas Dolby live mix. In a moment, we'll hear from the Idaho-bred singer-songwriter Josh Ritter performing live music from his new album, The Animal Years, and later, the surprising story of underground music in Iran. And you can email us if you like. Our email address is soundcheck@wnyc.org. So what?